Tips on Summer Gardening. We're heading into prime time for gardening this summer, as it's warm enough to spend the day preparing your soil and planting flowers, fruits, and vegetables. Maine's greenhouses are filled with blooming flowers and plants ready for a new home. For those of you without the space to plant, community gardens provide an opportunity to test your green thumb alongside your neighbors. The city of Portland alone has 11 community gardens managed by Cultivating Community. I'm Keith Shortall. Our experts are here to help answer your questions about gardening this summer. We'll talk to them about the best plants to add to your garden and about keeping your garden safe from the pests that emerge as temperatures rise. Maine Calling is next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. We're getting into those warmer days when Mainers venture outside to tend to their gardens. Spring flowers are starting to make way for new additions to your garden. What plants can survive the heat and the rain? We'll learn what to plant and when this hour. Joining me in studio, Pamela Hargest. She's a horticultural professional with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. And Bill Kalina is president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. And as always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about planting, pruning, weeding, and pest prevention? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, both of you, as we begin this discussion of gardening, which is so exciting every year at this time.
Thank you, Keith.
Memorial Day is, you know, the sort of the conventional, I guess, you know, if you had to remember when it's safe to plant. The frosts have sort of subsided. Memorial Day is the conventional date. Has this spring, Bill, has this spring's weather kind of altered any of the timetables for growing in Maine?
It's definitely been a slow spring. We haven't had late frost. It's just been the average temperature has been lower than normal, so things are a little bit more delayed. They're finally catching up with this last week that we've had. So I would say we're almost caught up to where we should be now.
Yeah. Pamela, any changes from where you sit?
Yeah, it's definitely been slow. And certainly for a lot of kind of warm weather vegetables, people have kind of been delaying their planting, which is, I think, a good thing. Hopefully we'll get some more sunny days coming up.
I did read in preparation for this, there was something about, though, not cleaning out your gardens too early because the, you know, whatever's left in there from the year before is kind of a haven for pollinators. So for bees and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly overwintering insects and, you know, things kind of living in the ground and hibernating. It's sometimes good to delay disturbing any of that or even cutting back some of your perennials just because things might be living in there. And, you know, the longer you can leave it there, sometimes the better.
And they can shelter in there at night, too, when it gets colder, even if they're out active.
Sort of thing.
All right. Well, let's talk about what should be, Bill, in the ground by this weekend. I guess it depends on seeds or versus seedlings, but what's the traditional, like?
I'll let Pamela kind of handle the veggie questions, but as far as the ornamental stuff, this is the time when typically, as you said, all the spring flowers, the tulips and things like that are gone back. If you have daffodils and other bulbs, don't cut them back after they're finished flowering. Let them die back on their own. But this is when we're putting in all of our summer annuals. It's safe to put in any of the warm season annuals that and there's so many different ones. Even what's gotten popular in the last few years are using tropical plants as annuals too, and it's maybe a little early for them. I like to wait till the night temperatures are getting at least above 55 or so before putting out what I would consider like truly tropical.
Give me an example of tropicals.
People use things like bananas and gingers, and there's all kinds of things that you might think of as house plants. Mm-hmm. But people plant them out as ornamentals just for the summertime too.
Right, and on the veggie side, what should we be thinking about right now?
Well, it's certainly not too late to plant any warm weather vegetables. So tomatoes and cucumbers and squash, all of those can still go in the ground. And sometimes some people are planting them for the first time right now. So because of that delayed weather, and other things probably are going to start coming up and ready to harvest. You know, I've seen a lot of greens at the farmer's market, and those root vegetables are starting to come out, like turnips and radishes. So,
are there any vegetables that you could plant now from seed, or is it too late?
Well, you know, you can still seed some cucumbers or squash. They grow relatively quickly. You'll get a little bit of a head start if you start with a seedling, but they do germinate quickly. And
do the seedlings do better? Is there a difference between how the seeds do versus?
Yeah, I always recommend seedlings for crops like cucumbers and squash, just because you get that head start, and you can actually plant another flush of them partway through the summer as well, because they're so quick at growing. But certain things, you know, cucumbers you can still start from seed, but certainly for pests are about to come out pretty soon. So if you put a seedling in the ground, you'll have more defense, more leaves to kind of keep those pests away.
Okay, and we'll get to pests in a moment. But I wanted to talk about soil first. And as I was doing, you know, my novice gardening, I, of course, turned to the internet. And there are, you know, sort of, I guess, different opinions about what needs to go into, for an example, for a raised bed. And I'm wondering, I'll start with, though, is preparing soil, first of all, what's the difference, I guess, between soil and dirt?
Dirt's what you get, you know, what you clean out from under your fingernails, and the soil is the stuff that, well, there's basically soil is made up of two different parts, the inorganic and the organic. So the inorganic is what's derived from rock, really, and there's different particle sizes. So we know sand. We know what sand is. That's the coarsest type of particles. And then you get into silts and clays, which are much finer. But it's all basically ground up rock. And then in addition to that is decomposed organic materials. And you need all those things to make a healthy soil. If you have all of one thing and none of the other, like you have all clay and nothing else, you're going to have a bad soil. If you have all sand, you got a bad soil. If it's just pure organic, it's not so good. So ideally, you want to have that imbalance, and it tends to be physically mostly the inorganic part, and then you add. But adding that organic component is the thing that is typically, if you're starting a new garden, that's what you would do. That the soils in Maine, the most of the soils in Maine are what you would consider like a sandy loam soil, so not terrible by themselves, but they are low in the organic components.
So things will grow if you just took the sod out and planted it, would grow. But you're going to benefit by adding some of these other things. But help us understand, for example, you know, loam versus topsoil. Like, let's just put it this way: for flowers, is there a sort of a simple ideal mixture?
Well, what topsoil can and loam are sort of interchangeable. And basically, what loam is a mixture of those three inorganic particles, the sand, the silt, and the clay, but heavy on the kind of the middle range. So that means that it holds some moisture because of the clay, and it also drains because of the sort of more coarse. So it's you're getting the best of both worlds. So it's a good starting point to have, but topsoil and loam typically have a little higher organic content. That's why they're darker in color. If the soil is like chocolate colored, it has a lot of organic material. If it's sort of a burnt sienna, you know, orange or gray, it typically has very little. And so you want to have more of that brown color, which means you got the organic stuff.
And so then you can add more nutrients. So manure versus compost, or can they be used together, or how do you measure these things, I guess, is the thing.
Yeah, there's certainly, as Bill mentioned, you adding a little bit of organic matter every year will benefit your garden, especially for vegetables and annual crops. Now, I'm just going to speak for extension here. Mm-hmm. We always recommend people to do soil tests, especially for vegetables or fruits that you're growing.
Because, for acidity or
You'll that's part of it. So you'll get your pH, you'll get a whole list of the macro, micronutrients and the percentage in which you have in your soils. And then based on that result and what you're growing, we'll give recommendations for any fertilizers or amendments you should make to your soil.
What does it cost to do that and how involved is it?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. The test itself, one sample is $18. You could do several samples if you have areas of your property that appear to be pretty different in kind of what Bill was describing there. So usually for small vegetable home gardeners, they'll only have to do one sample for, you know, their small area. And then it takes a few weeks to get your test results back. And then you have a really comprehensive list and you kind of know where to go from there.
And so do the results recommend what you need to do as well, in other words?
Exactly, yeah. And if you're an organic gardener, it'll give specific recommendations for organic. If you're just regular conventional home gardener with vegetables, then you'll get those results, which will be a little bit different.
Excellent. The number 1-800-399-3566. We'll take your questions in a few minutes here. Is it too early to worry about pests? Are we seeing them now?
Well, yeah. As Pam said, they're starting to really emerge. The caterpillars are coming out certainly, and the other the beetle pests and but there's some pests that are down in the soil and they're there all winter time. So, yeah, I start worrying about potential insect pests as soon as the ground thaws, basically. But it's getting to be the time when you start seeing a lot more.
All right. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to the phones a little early today and get in as many questions as we can. We'll start with Steve in Biddeford. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
I had a question. I heard that worms are really good for your garden. I've got some raised beds with garden soil and compost, and I've seen online a lot about using worm castings, and you have to make tea and feed them and all this stuff. I was wondering if I could just get some castings and just throw them out there and let them have at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Castings make a great compost to add to your garden, so I would definitely recommend adding them.
What do they do? What service do they provide?
Yeah, so, well, just like any other manure, worm castings is the poop of the worm. So it just adds nutrients, organic matter. It kind of has the same effect. Worm castings especially are pretty concentrated in nutrients, so it's a great thing to add to your home garden. Definitely not affordable for someone on a large scale, but for a home garden, it works well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve, thank you. We'll go to Tina in Belfast. Hi, Tina. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tina. Hi. Let me just turn this speakerphone off here. Here we go. I am calling with a question about a weed problem in my asparagus bed. And while I've been waiting, I did come up with a second question, if you have time for it when we're done with the first question.
Okay. We'll go with number one.
I have a pretty large asparagus bed, about 100 plants, and I spend a tremendous amount of time trying to keep up with the weeds. I am wondering if you have a suggestion for a companion plant that I could grow with the asparagus, either an annual that I would plant after they've headed out or, you know, towards the end, that would shade out weeds and prevent, you know, some of that germination, or if there's a low-growing perennial that would not outcompete and could possibly even benefit the bed.
Okay. Anyone want to tackle that?
Well, one thing I thought about is wild strawberries. You know, as a companion plant, they're a lot more aggressive than the cultivated strawberries, but they're delicious to eat. And they would compete for resources a little bit with asparagus, but they spread and make a nice. And they're, you know, the wild strawberries, usually they're coming up in people's lawns and that sort of thing too. You can put a fairly good layer of mulch on asparagus can have it poke through, and that will certainly help keep the annual weeds from germinating in there.
What's the best kind of mulch for vegetables?
I usually use sometimes I'll use just compost and put that right on as a mulch and let it work in. Hay and straw-based mulches are good for vegetable gardens, but the problem is they have weed seeds in them, so I'll just get straw and let it sit for a few weeks and get wet, and then some of those seeds germinate. There's getting to be more worry now about Roundup residues and straw, which is something people are concerned about. But I don't know what you use, Pamela, but I don't use things like bark mulch on vegetables, the wood-based mulches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pamela?
Yeah, I think definitely mulches that kind of break down more quickly. Wood chips would take too long to break down. But yeah, I often use straw or leaves. Leaves make a great mulch. You'll have to chop them up a little bit in the fall because they'll kind of blow around if you apply them directly to your garden. But those work really well.
I was wondering, can you use rhubarb leaves? They're big, and I know they're not something you want to ingest, but someone had mentioned that you could use those to cover as weed cover.
Yeah, you could use them. I think I would prefer to use leaves, just fallen leaves rather than mm-hmm. rhubarb leaves, though.
Yeah. Okay. Tina, you had another question.
Yes, I would like to grow dogwood, a couple of dogwood trees in my yard, and I actually planted a couple in an area that I thought that they'd do well. A slightly acidic soil, partial shade, and both of them have died back quite a ways. The stem is, you know, still shows a little bit of green if you scratch it, and just now down at the base, a couple of buds are starting to pop out, but definitely all the branches died back. I'm wondering if there's a certain variety that I should look for, or you know, if there's any considerations such as amount of moisture, or you know, and anything else that I should consider to try to get some success in growing a dogwood tree in my yard.
So you're talking about the flowering dogwood, Tina?
Correct, flowering dogwood. Yes.
The problem we've had is that a lot of them just aren't hardy in Maine because most of the dogwoods come from seed stock from the south. We have had better luck with a cultivar called Appalachian Spring, which is also somewhat resistant to the dogwood blight that affects dogwoods. So I'd try to see if you can find that one. And then we have very good luck with the Japanese dogwoods, which seems counterintuitive, but the Kusa, the Chinese or Japanese dogwoods, the Kusa dogwoods do very well for us too.
All right, Tina, best of luck. Thank you for calling in. And again, the number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll take a short break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine Energy Audit and Insulation Rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Beth's Farm Market of Warren, featuring a selection of seasonal and locally grown fruits, vegetables, and herbs, fresh picked daily. More at bethsfarmmarket.com.
As a reporter in Shanghai, Frank Langfitt had an idea: free rides in exchange for conversation. So he slapped some signs on his car.
And they said it was a free loving heart taxi.
A free loving heart
yes.
taxi.
Mianfei Aixingche in Chinese.
And sounds better in Chinese.
It's much better in Chinese.
They look at China from the inside of a taxi cab this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine Public News Tell Me More tour is underway as we travel the state to hear directly from you and learn what you think are the most important issues in your community and how Maine Public News can best serve you and keep you informed. We're headed to Augusta this evening. It starts at 5:30 at the Governor Hill Mansion at 136 State Street. Senior news editor Keith Shortall and State House political reporter Steve Missler will be on hand to discuss stories and issues being covered. For more information about all the Tell Me More tour visits, please visit mainpublic.org and click on events or the banner ad.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, summer gardening. My guests today are two experts, Bill Kulina, president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and Pamela Hargest is a horticulture professional from the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. From Twitter, Nancy in Cape Porpoise says, help, voles ate my entire well-established hosta bed over the winter. Does anything work to deter them? And should I put down some kind of physical barrier, chicken wire, prior to replanting? Voles are, you know, these little rodents.
They look kind of like mice with short tails.
Yeah.
And they're related to lemmings, you know, so they tend to move into an area where there's an abundant food supply and eat everything that's there, and then they move on somewhere else. We get a lot of questions about voles. It's one of those things that, you know, there isn't a foolproof way of getting rid of voles. One of the things that we do is if we have what they love is being next to places like stone walls, or if you have ornamental grasses or a meadow or something like that where they can go and hide, it gets harder. But if you have perennial gardens, even though we talked about the benefit of leaving your dead stems up in the wintertime, removing a lot of that cover in your garden helps scare them away in the fall, because they're worried about hawks and owls and things like that, so they'll go other places. But if you the chicken wire, and it doesn't work that well because it makes it very. All they have to do is just get under one section of it, and they can root around.
Because they can dig.
Yeah. So we do actually set snap traps for them at the botanical gardens in the fall, just to keep the population at a manageable level. But we realize that they're always around, and the foxes and the owls and things are feeding on.
How do you know that it's voles? I mean, other than seeing them, do they leave?
They make shallow tunnels. Often you'll see them in the lawn in the spring if the snow melts and you've got these, basically the grass is all chewed up and there's sort of not a tunnel, but just sort of a channel cut through your lawn. And you'll see tunnels in perennial gardens and where they've gone through, and then they really excavate out around the crowns of plants. Moles get blamed for a lot of the damage that voles do, but the difference is voles eat plants and moles eat insects, and you know that they don't eat plants, and so the voles are the ones that are doing all the plant damage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Easton and Nat. Hi, Nat. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks. Go ahead.
So, my question is: if any of the people on the panel have tried growing sweet potatoes here in Maine? I bought some slips this year. I haven't put them in yet. I don't know anyone growing them, or anyone who has. I'm just wondering what panel's got to say.
Yeah, so we've had pretty good luck growing sweet potatoes in southern Maine, for sure. My biggest recommendation is that sweet potatoes really need heat and warm soils. So we usually grow them under some sort of black plastic. And if you do that, and especially if you're able to warm up the soil a little bit more in advance before planting by putting the black plastic down for a week or so, and then plant right into the soil there through the plastic. That would be my biggest recommendation for growing sweet potatoes. But, you know, we've had pretty good luck in Portland area, and I think further north as well.
So it's all about keeping the soil warm.
Yeah, keeping it warm, and that'll help keep down the weeds too. So,
yeah. Are there other sort of vegetables like that do better with warmer soil that might benefit from the black plastic?
Yeah. So other things like tomatoes and peppers, eggplant, even cucumbers and squash, anything that likes warm weather would certainly benefit from that. But especially for sweet potatoes, I'd recommend it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Best of luck. Let's go to Millbridge and Danielle. Hi, Danielle. Hi, Danielle.
Hi. I'm sorry. I was just getting it off speaker and reparking.
Okay. Yeah.
Hi. My question is about a cherry tree transplant. We moved from the Hudson Valley, and I had a non-grafted white weeping cherry that had wonderful fruit. My understanding when we transplanted a volunteer from that tree is that it takes a very special genetic variation for a volunteer to turn into a weeper, and in fact, it won't be. But what I have right now is the transplanted, it's essentially like a shrub. The main stalk has not been sprouting any leaves, but there are a lot of very healthy-looking suckers coming off of it. I'm wondering if it's worthwhile trying to turn it into a bush, and also if it might bear fruit.
I think you could certainly turn it into a bush. It sounds like it might have a little bit of a winter hardiness issue up there in Millbridge. Typically to get good fruit, you're going to need something to pollinate that. So you'd need to have another individual of that species or one that it can cross-pollinate with to get the fruit. That's assuming that, to complicate things, Danielle, the seedling may be a hybrid between your weeping tree and another cherry, and so it potentially could be sterile too. It's really hard to know without seeing what would happen. But there are enough cherries around that you could kind of see how it goes. Just see if you get any fruit set on it. Sorry, I couldn't be too more specific. There's just a lot of variables there.
Cherries have a hard time generally in Maine winters.
Yeah, there are some varieties that are pretty, like Hallie Jolivet, which is a shrub cherry, is a good, reliable ornamental cherry. The typical weeping cherries are good, but it is a little bit of a hard climate, and if there's late frosts or freeze thaws and that sort of thing.
Danielle's calling from Millbridge. Z from Millbridge writes, "I just wanted to take a moment to tell listeners to visit Incredible Edible Millbridge in Millbridge. It's a series of free public pick-your-own vegetable gardens and education initiatives spread all throughout Millbridge. Organic vegetables can be cost prohibitive, but Incredible Edible allows anyone, regardless of their background, to come and pick what they want and need for dinner." Thanks, Z, for that. Let's go to David in Gorham. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hello. I have a question. Both of the presenters had recommended not using wooden mulch on garden beds. I've recently chipped a lot of brush and have put that on my beds and wondering if I made a mistake.
Yeah, so now, David, are you referring to perennial beds or vegetable beds?
Vegetable beds, specifically tomatoes.
Yeah, so I would pull those off if you can, especially fresh chipped wood like that. It can actually bind up the nitrogen in your soil. And so you'd be better off using something else like we had talked about earlier, leaf mulch or straw in that case. And I mean, you could pull off the wood chips, and a lot of times we recommend aging them for a year or so, and they would be great on a perennial bed. Or in between, if you have raised beds or paths, you wanted to make a path for your garden.
Yeah. What about these colored mulches that we see, in the sort of the big box stores or other places, which are, there's red, brown, and black typically. And I've read there's some controversy suggesting that they probably should be avoided. They might be okay for some uses, but that in some cases, you don't know what's in them. People are suspicious of the dyes. Do you have any opinion about that, either of you?
I think it's a big scam, that's been perpetrated on the public, because they come from different sources, but a lot of it is basically construction debris that's chipped up and then dyed, and so you've got residues of pressure treated wood, arsenic, lead, all those things that are in construction debris. It's also completely uncomposted or aged, like what Pam was saying, so that you put that stuff on the soil, it really binds up a lot of the nitrogen in your soil, and you get nitrogen deficiency in your plants. And then you've got the dye, too. So I always recommend people, like if they like the garden to look red or orange or yellow or something, just do that in Photoshop. You know, take a picture and do it that way. But put composted. If you want to use a bark material, get something that's truly composted, composted pine bark or something like that.
All right, David, thank you. We'll go to Gardner next and Eileen. Hi, Eileen.
Hi there.
It's a good name. It's a good town name for what we're talking about, Gardner. But go ahead.
I bought a house about a year ago. When the house was built in the 70s, the developers stripped all the topsoil off the land. So what I have remaining is sand. I did not know that when I bought the house because I have had spectacular perennial gardens in the past. The result of all the sand is millions and millions of ants. And I have started building up gardens, but the ants still come through. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you would recommend as to try and deter? There are ants everywhere. And so that's one question. The second question is, I want to lay down some heavy black plastic to kill off the sod in a place where there was, at one point, a vegetable garden. And I would like to know how thick a black plastic would be appropriate for that job.
Okay, well, we'll do the ants first, I guess. First of all, do ants interfere with, I mean, are they a bad thing to have, I guess, around gardens?
Not. Particularly, but as she said, there's certain species. There's one particular that's a colonizing, perennial species. And if they love dry sandy soil because it's better for the young, and they'll get in and take over huge areas. And they do churn the soil up. You can kind of Google online. There are kind of organic biological controls for ants to try, but I think you hit it on the head, Eileen, that the sandy soil is the real problem, and that that happens a lot during development where the soil is stripped off and sold. So that's another sort of tidbit. If you're going to build a house, work with your contractor and say that you don't want any material to leave the site, and that means you're going to have a place to stockpile it. But they, you know, that you own that, and you should. You know, you should be able to keep it, because the problem typically, too, is if you buy back in soil, you get these invasive things like Japanese bamboo coming in, too. They're going to be headaches. So the best thing is don't let it leave the site.
Yeah. And Pamela, on the black plastic, she wanted to know the best thickness.
Yeah. So I would say, I mean, generally we do 6 millimeters plastic. So that you can find that through any kind of agricultural resource online. Some nurseries might sell products like that as well. You could go a little bit thinner than that, but that ensures that it's not going to rip or anything if you're going to be storing it, or if there's a chance that people are going to be walking on top of the plastic.
All right, Eileen, best of luck. The number 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Bernstein Scher, attorneys who believe understanding your business goals is just as important as knowing the law. BernsteinScher.com. Friends School of Portland, for preschool through grade 8, teaching peace in a changing world. More information at friendsschoolofportland.org. And Dead River Company, celebrating 110 years, delivering propane and heating oil to fellow Mainers. DeadRiver.com.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Stacey Abrams talks to Alexis Madrigal about her run for the governor's seat in Georgia, the unparalleled importance of voters' rights, and the question on many people's minds, will she run for president? That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
More Native Americans hold elected office now than ever before. What impact are they having at the federal, state, and local levels? We'll talk to the politicians making history now and working hard to have their stories heard. Next time on 1A.
And you can hear 1A tonight at 9 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, gardening in Maine in the summertime. Joining me, Bill Kalina is with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and Pamela Hargest is with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. Elizabeth is asking, what's with all the brown plants? Can Bill talk about death in the garden after 6 months of ice and snow? I lost many shallow rooted ground covers, lamb ears, green and gold. My neighbor's evergreens are a mess. Can they be saved? I've invested in annuals to fill in all the holes, but what attractive ground covers can you recommend that will survive this new ice age?
Well, Elizabeth, I hope that this was an abnormal year and not the new normal, because it was a hard year. I think it was at least where we are, there was a lot of rain followed by sort of freezing rain and then frozen, and then ice, and then it would thaw, and then we'd get rain and ice, and that's just the worst thing for evergreens. Have especially struggle in the spring when you have the bright sun in March and the ground is still frozen and icy. They can't replace the water they're losing. And things like lamb's ears hate moisture and that sort of moisture in the ground. So as far as ground covers, the ground covers that are not evergreen are going to have an easier time, and ground covers that are not what you consider sort of a drought, drought tolerant or preferring ground covers. I actually use, more than anything, I use the native ferns as ground covers. There's lots of different native ferns, and they do very well in partly shaded or even, more sun, and they seem very adaptable not knowing specifically the kind of conditions that she's looking for. It's hard to give her a specific thing. But I look at the native ferns, sedges, but avoid maybe some of the evergreen things.
Okay. Let's go to Brookton Township and Tony. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hey, how's it going? Thank you for your program today. I had a tip on slug control, because I have slugs, and don't we all? But I've tried the baits. They don't really work that well. And I get out there early in the morning, especially on damp mornings, with a pair of long pointed scissors and attack the slugs with them, and it works very well.
Yeah, any slug thoughts?
No, that sounds great if that's working for you. We're lucky in our garden. We haven't had too much of a trouble with slugs, but yeah, that sounds like a great tip.
All right, Tony, thanks for the tip. We'll go to Adair in South Bristol. Hi, Adair.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my questions. I actually have two. First off, for decades, we had an abundance of lady slippers, and over the last years, we just watched them fade away. We have no more. How can we bring them back? And my second question is, I love patty pan squash from my childhood, but I'm having trouble growing them, and last year my crop just produced 3 squash. So I'd love any tips you have about growing patty pans.
Okay.
Take the lady slipper and Pam can take the patty pan.
Okay.
Pam's patty pants. The pink lady slippers actually are, they like situation where there's been canopy disturbance in a forest. So it's been a blowdown of trees, or the trees have been cut, or there's a road put in, or, a house put in or something like that lets a little bit more light in. And as the forest gets more mature, assuming that the forest hasn't been disturbed in any kind of, dug up or anything like that, that they will start to fade off. But the amazing thing about lady slippers is they can live underground for years. And because they associate with a particular fungus that they're parasitizing. And then so they can live underground for years. And then when there's more light, they can sense the ground's warmer, they come back up again. So what I would try is, if you can go into your woods, Adair, and just thin out some of the weaker saplings or trees, or limb up trees that, some of the larger trees, try to let a little more light in through the canopy. And that's really the best thing. And hopefully the lady slippers are still there and they'll come back again.
And the squash?
Well, I would say that the patty pan squash isn't too different from other squashes you would grow as far as what's recommended. My first thought is just thinking that perhaps a soil test could be helpful, kind of looking at your nutrient level. Also, I love to use straw or some type of mulch around my squash plants and cucumbers. I think that helps prevent any kind of disease or insects. But, you know, generally they're pretty much the same as other squashes. And maybe I'd look at doing a different type of variety for a patty pan. You know, Johnny's has a lot of really great options that do pretty well up here in Maine.
All right, Adair, good luck with that. Julie, just listening in the car and have a possible solution for weeds in the asparagus patch. A friend uses table salt liberally spread and swears it keeps down weeds. He has great asparagus. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not heard of that. Have you heard of that, Bill?
No. Hmm. But, I mean, it's certainly salt is toxic to a lot of plants, and I have heard that asparagus is a little bit more salt tolerant than other things, so it sort of makes sense. You're creating kind of a toxicity that it can survive and the other things can't. So it doesn't, and generally, it wouldn't be something I would recommend to people as a soil treatment, but
goes well with peppers. I'm just sorry. That's just terrible. Let's go to Joan in Cushing. Hi Joan. Oh. Sorry. Joan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Last year, we bought an American Spring flowering dogwood, and we purchased it in southern Connecticut and very carefully located it. We're on the coast, in mid-coast, about maybe 80 feet from the ocean. And we sited it between two structures. It got the right amount of sun, the right amount of moisture, but unfortunately it died. So this is actually more of a comment that we wanted that to survive, but it didn't seem to make it.
Yeah, we've definitely, and that's been one of the ones that survived best at the Botanical Gardens, but we've tried a lot of the American dogwoods. Believe it or not, the flowering dogwood is native to Maine. And one of the things that we're interested in doing in the future is research on going and getting seeds from these local populations of plants like flowering dogwood that grows up in sort of southern Maine, York County, and actually getting those out there into the, you know, for gardeners, because it should be able to survive. But again, I think the better choice may be to try one of the Coosa dogwoods, which isn't quite the same, but certainly have done far, far better for us in general than the flowering dogwood.
All right, Joan, thank you. Pat writes, we use diatomaceous earth instead of insecticides for our vegetables. Would it be helpful to mix it into our raised garden soil?
It wouldn't necessarily be harmful. I would probably just hold off on using that, though, until you actually have a problem where it would be beneficial to add, though.
And what is, just help remind us, diatomaceous earth, and why does it have anti-pest powers?
Yeah, it can definitely help with certain insects and kind of clog up their mouth pieces, this type of...
It's diatoms, which you've heard of, which are sort of, you know, they're silicate, and mm-hmm. they have silicate shells. And so when they die over millions of years, they get these deposits that's sort of like a sand. And so it's basically like tiny shards of glass that cut soft-bodied insects up. So you can imagine walking across a carpet of broken glass. So I think the question is, like, it needs to be somewhat concentrated to have that
right.
effect. If it's just an occasional piece here
right.
or there,
you can get around it. Yeah. All right. Let's go to Kittery Point and Catherine. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It pertains a little bit to the call a few calls ago about the dieback of the evergreen. I have blue rug junipers all over the slope in front of my yard because I don't like grass. And there's little bits of green showing, but little bits, maybe 5% of the entire mass of junipers out there. Do I have any hope that they might come back, or should I just say goodbye to them?
5% is pretty low. I'd give it a couple more weeks, but I would say the prognosis is not good. But you know, you may find that give them a couple more weeks because it's been cool and it's just starting to warm off. They may actually sprout out more out of more places than you're seeing right now.
Just a couple of minutes left here. We'll go to Peter in Portland. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking the call. I have a quick question. In the effort to grow some Shasta daisies, I created raised beds and got 50-50 topsoil and compost. And then I decided, why not have UMaine Extension give me a real premium report on the soil. So they did a fantastic report. It's telling me that two amendments were needed. And unfortunately, I raced to the phone here and don't have my paperwork in front of me, so I don't have the amendments they recommended. But my question is, was that a one-time amendment recommendation, or should I do that annually?
Usually the recommendations are a one-time amendment based on
the test
at that time, because you'll find, you know, if by adding different materials over time or whatever you plant, those nutrients are going to change. So one-time change to your soil.
All right. Thank you, Peter. I don't have time to go to these calls, but I'll ask the questions on their behalf. First, Bryant wants to know if coffee grounds added to soil adds nutrition to the plants. Yeah, Bill?
Yeah, it does add some nitrogen, and it's an organic material, so it's helping with that organic content we talked about before. It does, you know, it's acidic, so it can lower the pH a little bit too.
And Wendy from Yarmouth is asking, she has some bittersweet in her yard and is wondering if there's anything she can do to eradicate it.
Very tough to get rid of. Other than using herbicides, the best thing you can do is to cut and then try to pull out the roots as much as you can. But it's one of those things where you cut a big stem and 100 little ones come up. So it requires a lot of people turn to the herbicides, something like, you know, the Brush Be Gone type herbicide for those things to cut the stem and paint just on the wound. But others don't really like herbicides. It's just going to be a lot of careful, you know, years of pulling it out.
Yeah. Anything to add, Pamela? No. Yeah.
No, not really. That's exactly what I would say too. It's going to be a long process if you don't use any type of herbicide.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Really appreciate it, Pamela. Bill, thanks so much for coming in. Really interesting show.
Yeah, thank you.
Pamela Hargest is a horticulture professional from the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. And Bill Kalina is the president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Lucy Suchek ran the board today, and Julie Pike answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.